Good evening and welcome back on this Saturday, the 28th day of November, 2020. I'm your host, Mark Call. And since this marks the end of a very busy week, in spite of the fact that it contains a holiday and now a holiday weekend, and given the unprecedented level of outright, undeniable, in-your-face lies by the waystream media, or what George Orwell called the Ministry of Truth, we better start off our look at what really happened this week towards the end, and then go back and fill in the gaps. President Trump took questions from reporters on Thursday evening, Thanksgiving Day, for the first time since the election, and after confirming a few days ago via Twitter that he would tell the GSA to initially begin at least a tiny part, your host interjects here, of the so-called transition process, the president confirmed to a group of waystream media journalists that he would formally surrender power to Biden should Trump's rival win the Electoral College vote. And during what the Zero Hedge summary called the scrum, Trump took about 25 minutes to rehash a series of allegations that his legal team has made so far, while flatly saying that Biden couldn't have done as well as he did without, and I would say obviously, fraud. Reporters, of course, as the summary, leapt at the opportunity to ask all kinds of salacious questions. Trump was asked if he'd physically leave the White House if the Electoral College confirms Biden's, let's put it correctly, folks, theft. Trump replying, "Certainly I will, and you know that." And after a round of antagonistic questions, Trump started lashing out at various states for dropping the ball and ruining his chances at a second term, while reiterating that this was, quote, a rigged election at the highest level. He went on to slam Georgia's Secretary of State, who penned an op-ed slamming Trump and his supporters as an enemy of the people, adding he'd soon stage a rally in Georgia, where voters returned to the polls in early January for a pair of runoff Senate races that will determine control of the upper chamber. Finally, Trump repeatedly returned to questioning Joe Biden's alleged raw vote total, insisting that he couldn't possibly have done so well compared to previous Democrats who could actually draw a crowd. Quote, "This is not a candidate that can get 80 million votes," he said of Biden. "Folks, this isn't a candidate that could draw enough people to fill a high school auditorium, even with socialist distancing and free pizza." The only way, said Trump, that he got 80 million votes is through massive fraud. He even declined to say whether he'd attend Biden's bogus inauguration, as is the custom, say stories like the one in the Daily Mail, for an outgoing president. I think if they did some checking, they'd see the custom is different for banana republics. I do like what he did say, however. Quote, "I'll be honest, I know the answer, but I just don't want to say it yet." Oh, wait, and here your host has to stop and admit I really would like to know what he was thinking there. How do you accessorize an orange jumpsuit? Is it nice in Guantanamo this time of year? Yeah, the mind boggles. Before adding that it's not right that Biden has already started picking his cabinet. But continuing my theme, folks, maybe it'll make the list of subpoenas easier to compile. By midday Friday, though, the Daily Mail, among others, was backtracking what they were saying earlier with this addition. President Donald Trump said on Friday that Joe Biden can only enter the White House if he can prove his votes are not fraudulent. A step back, they say, from Thursday's admission that he would cede the residence for his communist rival, they didn't put it correctly, in a peaceful transfer of power. And that, folks, let's be honest here, is simply no longer even a remote possibility. Here's how Trump tweeted it. "Biden can only enter the White House as president if he can prove that his ridiculous 80 million votes were not fraudulently or illegally obtained. When you see what happened in Detroit, Atlanta, Philadelphia, and Milwaukee, massive voter fraud, he's got a big, unsolvable problem." Unquote. Whereupon they go on to parrot the usual BS that they've been pushing ever since the fraud circus began. "Trump has refused to concede the election, despite Biden's massive lead in the fraudulent popular vote and fraudulent alleged electoral college, which, truthfully, folks, hasn't met, certainly hasn't voted, and certainly hasn't been certified, much less adjudicated." And get this, they're still saying this even after what we'll get to in just a second. The president's campaign has shown no evidence of massive voter fraud, and state officials have also said the election was smoothly run. Well, they got away with it, didn't they? In hindsight, I guess the Warren Commission could have said the same thing about the Kennedy assassination and cover-up. I do want to get around to the voluminous amount of actual evidence and information that the Daily Mail, New York Times, WAPO, CNN, and the rest of the waystream media continue to try to deny even exists concerning the greatest election fraud attempt in U.S. history, arguably ever, although certainly some of the same tools have been used in previous efforts, as the evidence being revealed also now makes pretty clear. Before the Thanksgiving holiday, as promised, Sidney Powell released the Kraken with dual lawsuits in both Michigan and Georgia. The 104-page complaint filed in the U.S. District Court in Atlanta alleges the purpose of the scheme was, quote, to illegally and fraudulently manipulate the vote count to make certain the election of Joe Biden as President of the United States. And she said that old-fashioned ballot stuffing has been amplified and rendered virtually invisible by computer software created and run by domestic and foreign actors for that very purpose, adding that mathematical and statistical anomalies rising to the level of impossibilities, as shown by affidavits of multiple witnesses, documentation, and expert testimony, evince this scheme across the state of Georgia. And in fact, she says the scheme and artifice to defraud affected tens of thousands of votes in Georgia alone and rigged the election for Georgia for Joe Biden. She talks about things like the rushed purchase of the tainted Dominion voting machines and software without due diligence but with disregard for safety concerns, the breach of both physical security and professional standards in the voting machines and software, in violation of both state and federal laws, and even the bogus claim about the water leak used to cover up the fraud. The lawsuit asks for over a dozen remedies, including an injunction blocking the state from certifying results, in which Biden allegedly won by a mere 12,000, from being transmitted to the Electoral College. And furthermore, the Powell suit also demands an audit where signatures are actually matched, along with the impounding of various election machines and video surveillance from vote-counting areas, or better put, maybe vote fraud areas. In the state of Michigan, Powell's 75-page complaint seeks to set aside the results of that election, too, claiming that, quote, hundreds of thousands of illegal, ineligible, duplicate, or purely fictitious ballots enabled massive election fraud, to the end that, as in Georgia, the purpose of the fraudulent manipulation was to manufacture an election victory for Joe Biden, adding that in this case, the most troubling, insidious, and egregious ploy involved, quote, systemic adaptation of old-fashioned ballot stuffing. But in both cases, the real bombshell had to do with the Dominion systems and software designed by Smartmatic Corporation, founded by foreign oligarchs and dictators, which, quote, negligently allowed foreign adversaries to access data and intentionally provide access to their infrastructure in order to monitor and manipulate elections, including this one in 2020. And note, folks, the implications there. Which leads me next to some comments about an analysis that I saw online concerning the Sidney Powell filing in Georgia via commentator Vox Day, by a self-described experienced attorney with 25 years in practice who says the last 15 he'd spent mainly representing persons in federal courts accused of crimes. So, he says, I'm quite familiar with federal court procedures and other matters. And here are at least a few of the points he makes concerning the 104-page Powell complaint. In early October, number one says, a federal district judge in the same district, Northern District of Georgia, ruled after several years of litigation that the Dominion software used to monitor this election has substantial issues and it will affect an election. Looks like it did. The plaintiffs were Democrats in that case who filed suit in response to the 2016 election and sought an order forcing Georgia to use different software. They conducted discovery and hearings over years, including 3 days of expert testimony about how these very voting machines work. The court ultimately denied that request because it was simply too late to change the voting machines since the election at that time was roughly less than a month away. New cases are supposed to be assigned to judges randomly, says the attorney, but I wouldn't be surprised if this case were given to that same particular judge since she spent so much time reviewing the litigation and conducting evidentiary hearings. Her findings of fact could be incorporated into this hearing under the legal theory of res judicata. It goes on to say that the complaint makes good use of a wide variety of legal sources from both political parties, specifically naming a statement from Democrat Senators Warren, Klobuchar, and Wyden from 2019 regarding the Dominion software, including evidence from previous litigation. And you know what, folks? Here's where I say it again. It really, really angers me that the lying waste stream press keeps repeating the mantra that there's no evidence, when in fact they have cited volumes of it. And you'd think an honest press would at least acknowledge, even if we don't like the evidence, at least you'd hope they'd have the shame to quit lying about it and claiming there isn't any, for crying out loud. So among this denied evidence, and back to the analysis here, the plaintiffs, including those Democrats, say, among other things, look, for the past 15-plus years, Republicans, Democrats, and a wide variety of international media groups have pointed out the problems with Dominion software, so it shouldn't be a surprise we're here. And the very problems they have pointed out are problems we see in this election, unquote, even if the waste stream press is lying through their damnable teeth about the total lack of such evidence. Another item says the complaint relies upon a variety of evidence to support its claims. One, says the author, is the examination of the history of Dominion software. Another is expert testimony regarding the voting patterns seen in this election. Another is eyewitness testimony of ballot switching. Another is evidence of votes being cast by ineligible persons. Another is evidence of a similar pattern of conduct in several high population counties. And viewed together, plaintiffs make a strong case. But, says the attorney, it's one thing to say something and another to prove it. And I guess, folks, I'll say it again. It's one thing to say there's no evidence in spite of the facts and another thing to lie entirely about it. Now, let me put it this way. I could at least respect honest reporting that says we've looked at their evidence and we see that it contains some flaws and here they are. Give their readers and listeners credit for some intelligence. Those of us that haven't been completely dumbed down are fully capable of looking at the evidence in both directions and making up our own minds. But when a lying press simply says, there isn't any, we're not going to allow you to see it because we're going to ban anybody that even tries to post it, you know the fix is in. And the conspiracy here is no longer a fiction. It's a great big stinking fact, like evidence they don't want you to see. Another item says this analysis, where the plaintiffs do a good job, is pointing out the number of votes affected by the alleged fraud. One reason this is crucial is that Biden's certified margin of victory in Georgia was only about 12,000 votes. And the complaint does a good job of laying out substantial procedural and constitutional irregularities with roughly 96,000 votes and further problems with additional votes. The problematic votes far outnumber Biden's margin of victory, which is hugely significant. In this case, the number of problem votes amount to 8 times the alleged margin of victory. So even a small fraction of those, in other words, going the opposite direction, completely changes the outcome. Or if the problem votes simply go away, Biden's victory is gone as well. The complaint does a good job of pointing out not just the alleged problems, but the number of votes affected by those problems. So what now, asks this attorney. The plaintiffs are asking for an evidentiary hearing, which would allow them to present evidence in the form of witness testimony, expert testimony, and exhibits that would support their claim. And because this is a civil case, they only have to prove their case by a preponderance of evidence. That is, just prove that it was more likely than not that there was fraud and that the fraud influenced the election. They do not, because it's a civil case, have to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. And folks, given the statistical evidence here alone, it's pretty much provable beyond a statistical reasonable doubt. So this is a pretty low burden for something that is downright obvious at this point. The court, says the attorney, though, may refuse an evidentiary hearing, in which case the plaintiffs would appeal and argue that they be given one. And given the evidence laid out, he notes, I expect the court will at least order an evidentiary hearing to be conducted on an expedited scale. And it also helps that there is one being set for Nevada. What's most important, though, says the attorney, is not so much the judge's legal decision as it is the judge's factual decisions, which will likely be relied upon by appellate judges, even if they disagree with the legal conclusions of the first judge. So if there is an evidentiary hearing, pay careful attention to the judge's factual findings. Starting with the fact that, for one, this is federal, not state. That's highly important for federal jurisdiction. So the law requires that all records related to the election of a president, vice president, and or senators be kept for at least 22 months after an election. If the court sets a hearing, watch for that request for the evidence. And if the court orders an evidentiary hearing, I'd expect, he says, that the court would order the evidence provided to the plaintiffs and to the court. If it's not provided, that is, if the Georgia Division of Elections doesn't have the data that's required by federal statutes, there'll likely be hell to pay. He puts it this way, and I think we have some doubts on this score. I can't imagine anybody would be so monumentally stupid as to either erase such information or not have kept it. Well, folks, you might think that the FBI wouldn't be helping some people to bleach bit hard drives and then smash them into non-existence, too. Maybe that, says your host, helps explain why they're in such a hurry to declare Biden the victor and destroy the evidence. However, he says, plaintiffs specifically allege that the voting machines do not keep copies of the original paper ballots and are designed to avoid this audit trail. In other words, folks, let's see that again. These machines are designed not only to fraudulently manipulate election results, but to cover their tracks as well, and violate election statutes in the process. No wonder there's so much evidence of massive whopping bribes. And one more point comes to your host's mind here. When you look back at the separation now of the Sidney Powell release of the Kraken from the Trump election campaign, i.e. Giuliani et al. Efforts, one other major element here comes into focus. There are civil cases associated with the election fraud itself. And then there should certainly be criminal cases associated with those who done it. One final point from this analysis. The plaintiffs also seek to compare votes cast with voter registrations, specifically people that have moved from Georgia and are no longer eligible to vote. And they allege 20,000 such votes cast by people who'd moved out of the state and were no longer eligible. And you strike those as illegitimate, and guess what happens to Biden's lead? There's a lot of really important other news as well this week. And since we've already started that way, let's continue more or less in reverse chronological order, starting with a lot of things that came out on or just before Thanksgiving Day. And this one actually did seem to get reported by the waste stream, along with some of the squealing sounds that stuck pigs make. President Trump has finally pardoned General Michael Flynn. And their statement basically says what everybody's known for a long time. He never should have been attacked in the first place because, quote, he is an innocent man. The appropriately lengthy statement says that the president has pardoned General Flynn because he never should have been prosecuted, and an independent review of the Flynn case by the DOJ, conducted by respected career professionals, they say, supports this conclusion, with the result that the full pardon finally brings an end to the relentless partisan pursuit of an innocent man, who they note should not require pardon, because he is, in fact, an innocent man. And they note even the FBI agents who interviewed General Flynn didn't think he was lying. There's a lot more, but let me summarize it this way. It basically boils down to how the previous administration didn't want a peaceful transition of power, wasn't about to allow it, and since they fell short of rigging the last election as effectively as they had this one, they had to use other ways of getting where they wanted to go. And we've seen that play out now for 4 years. Happy Thanksgiving, it concludes. From there, the only appropriate way to continue is a headline summary of all the things that are broken in just the last 24 hours before the holiday. Most of them dealing, one way or the other, with the question of impending civil war in America and whether or not there will still be a rule of law when the dust settles. And I'll start with just a few of the stories that headline the Gateway Pundit. Starting with some of those surrounding the hearing in the Pennsylvania legislature on Wednesday about the massive election fraud. There were audible gasps and laughter from both the crowd and the panel at that Pennsylvania hearing when one witness reported on spikes that sent 600,000 votes, allegedly at least, to Biden and only 3,200 for Trump. How's that for a bit of in-your-face statistical absurdity? Rudy Giuliani pointed out another major problem with the mail-in balloting in Pennsylvania. Only 1.8 million of them were sent out. Somehow or other, though, 2.5 million of them managed to get counted, arguably a lot of them more than once. One of the witnesses in Pennsylvania gave some explosive testimony, saying, quote, "I personally observed USB cards being uploaded to voting machines. There were literally baggies of USBs, and it turns out that now 47 of them seem to be missing, nowhere to be found. Who could have thought it?" After the hearing, Twitter banned the campaign account of the Pennsylvania senator that organized the election hearing in Gettysburg, and it's also been reported that a Pennsylvania lawmaker warned that the Democrat Governor Wolf mandated Dominion voting systems be used, and no, it was not approved by the legislature. On to the creepy senile one that the crooked press has deemed president-elect, I refer to him as Fuhrer-elect, because if this is allowed to happen, that's a lot closer to the truth. He got behind his teleprompter, took off his mask, and read somebody else's speech, the Thanksgiving address, standing behind a bogus little podium that says Office of President-elect, and managed to get a whole 1,000 viewers to watch. As TGP points out, this is the guy who allegedly got 80 million votes. But wait, there's another indicator as well. Supporters lined up to greet Creepy Joe on the highway. As his motorcade passed, he got 80 million votes. Well, sure, but only four of them showed up to wave at their hero. In another story, says the Gateway Pundit, they've got testimony from an international audit executive based in Hong Kong who says it is clear that fraud occurred in the 2020 election, and the current results embedded in that election with fraud he believes will be overturned. The point here is that the statistical proofs alone of massive and systemic fraud are literally overwhelming. A GOP poll watcher in Detroit has come forward. They call them poll challengers in Michigan. And he was challenged for sure, having been threatened with violence after having offered to check 35,000 ballots that were dumped in the middle of the night at the TCF Center, and was told, quote, I will kick your ass out of here. Makes you wonder how many felonies like this it takes to say there was something crooked afoot, or for that matter, what the lying press would call evidence. And finally, that brings us to the lawsuits, all filed just before the Thanksgiving break. Attorney Lynn Wood filed an emergency motion for an expedited review of his appeal in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. There's a new lawsuit that's been filed by the Trump legal team in the state of Georgia, separate from Sidney Powell's, and that affects thousands of illegal votes. And finally, as we've already talked about in some detail, Sidney Powell did, in fact, release the Kraken. And finally, since we are on the subject of court cases, the Supreme Court actually seems to have gotten one right. I guess you could call this good news on perhaps more than one front. One of which is that they finally blocked so-called officials in New York acting under color of law from limiting religious gatherings. Somebody actually pulled out and read the First Amendment. It's a win for Orthodox Jews who had been sued over restrictions imposed during the booga 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 flu COVID-1984 plandemic. Said the majority opinion, quote, members of this court are not public health experts, and by the way, folks, most of those that claim to be certainly aren't either, and we should respect the judgment of those with special expertise and responsibility in this area, they said, but even in a plandemic, and they spelled it wrong, the Constitution cannot be put away and forgotten. The restrictions at issue here, by effectively barring many from attending religious services, strike at the very heart of the First Amendment's guarantee of religious liberty, unquote. And in the 5-4 decision, gee folks, if we had an honest court, it would be 9-0. The nation's highest court said that the governor of New York, the slimy socialist Andrew Cuomo, cannot enforce occupancy limits set in a previous executive order. In a separate opinion, Justice Neil Gorsuch, Donald Trump appointee, siding with the majority, noted that churches and synagogues were being treated differently than commercial institutions by the almighty state. Quote, it's time, past time, to make plain that while the pandemic poses many grave challenges, there is no world in which the Constitution tolerates color-coded executive edicts that reopen liquor stores and bike shops but shutter churches, synagogues, and mosques. Unquote. Oh, and guess who dissented? The turncoat, eminently blackmailable so-called Chief Justice, John Roberts, who in a dissent said that there's simply no need, you peons, you, when we say jump, you say how high, to grant injunctive relief. And since when did we start caring about that Bill of Rights thing again anyway? And finally, Zero Hedge observed something important. Note that the court earlier this year declined to lift the pandemic restrictions in the People's Republic of California and Nevada when the late leftist anti-constitutionalist, so-called Justice RBG, was still infesting the court. And that, too, is arguably good news. We'll wrap up this first segment with one more bit of plot-thickening news from Friday morning, where Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who's been described by both U.S. and Israeli intelligence as the force behind Iran's nuclear weapons program, was assassinated in his vehicle during a drive-by attack. Various intelligence officials, says the New York Times coverage, have claimed that it was Israel and Mossad that was behind the attack, although it's unclear, they say, just how much the United States may have known about the operation in advance. The White House declined comment. Various U.S. policy officials have claimed that this was a setback to Iran's nuclear program, given their most senior scientists and the number one target of Mossad is now gone, while Iranian officials have called the attack an act of terror and vowed to take revenge. I guess as if the election wasn't enough. We'll be right back, though, after this. Welcome back now to the second segment of the show for this evening. I'm still your host, Mark Hall, and yes, we're still kind of taking a look back at the week that was in reverse chronological order. Well, sorta. We talked about the most recent stuff during the last segment. Now we need to fill in the gaps by taking a look back at some stories from not only earlier this week, but through the previous weekend. And given how ugly it's been, maybe the best way to start that off is with a bit of comic relief. And where better than the Bolshevik Izvestia, a.k.a. the New York Times? The trouble, of course, is that they're clueless as to why. Case in point, let's just look at a couple of the front page headlines. From The Conversation, opinion by Gail Collins and Brett Stevens, can this get any more pathetic, says the headline, and they're right. Again, they don't know why. But listen to this, and yes, I'll remind you up front, this is not the Babylon Bee or the Onion. Said Gail Collins, Brett, we're living through a time of extreme crisis. A sitting president refusing to acknowledge his re-election defeat. But when we look back, I have a feeling our sharpest memory will be Rudy Giuliani's melting hairline. Are you kidding me? And that, folks, is because they're so pitifully ignorant of all the other things that are really going on. Open treason, the biggest fraud in American history, and that's all these blithering idiots can manage to talk about? I'm hoping now, she says, you'll tell me I'm too shallow. No, Gail, you're just plain too stupid. But he says, no, not at all, Gail. Good grief. To call tripe like this vapid does a real disservice to airheads. But when it comes to opinion on the front page, the New York Times was just getting rolling. Here's another one. What makes Trump's subversion efforts so alarming? His collaborators. The subheadline by these laughably ignorant professors says, the president has been trying to dismantle our shared beliefs about democracy. I wonder if they mean, like, we were never supposed to have had one, and now his fellow Republicans are helping him. What, by reading the Constitution and pointing out that certain pieces there were put in place exactly for situations like this? For things like insurrection, traitors from within, and open fraud? They don't say it. I will. The point of their piece seems to be that the fact that this system can be so openly rigged might result in a spiral of distrust. Not only in corrupt election officials and software, your host would add, but in a corrupt fourth estate, too. And the danger they worry about is that all of this lying, cheating, and stealing might even affect, quote, Democratic voters' faith in democracy, too. Why, who knows, folks? A few of them might even try to pull out a copy of that Constitution thingy and read it. I would challenge them. Find the word democracy in there, or in the Bill of Rights, or even the Declaration of Independence, anywhere. And how else do we conclude this little look at insanity gone waste stream? Answer, one last opinion piece, also from the front page of the New York Times. It says, and I'm not kidding, quote, your brain is not for thinking. If it was, they should warn their readers, you wouldn't be reading rags like this. By the way, the reason I even went to this particularly disgusting source was to see just how exactly they were spinning the Sidney Powell revelations over the weekend. And the top story I found was this. Trump team disavows lawyer who peddled conspiracy theories on voting. Yes, it says in what passes for the news part, President Trump's campaign issued a striking repudiation of Sidney Powell, who had offered up widely derided, well, at least by them, conspiracy theories as she tried to aid the president's baseless challenges to vote counts. How's that for objective and truthful? Oh, by the way, the piece is written by, among others, Maggie Haberman, so maybe we shouldn't be surprised. And they're, of course, baseless because we wouldn't cover the evidence if a tree fell on top of us and made sound. Like so much of the crap that's being spun by the likes of the WAPO and New York Times, though, when you cut through it, you see this is the only teeny little bit of meat in there. The Trump campaign team, in a statement on Sunday, said, quote, Sidney Powell is practicing law on her own. And yeah, folks, she's one of the very best in the entire country. She is not a member of the Trump legal team. She is also not a lawyer for the president in his personal capacity, unquote. And since it would be quite unlike the New York Times to actually comment intelligently about what all this means, let's go to some better sources. And there are, not too surprisingly, a ton of them. From Joe Hoft at the Gateway Pundit, Michael Flynn Jr. has released more information on the Trump team Sidney Powell statement, and it's not what you think. We pretty well guessed that, the way the New York Times tried to spin it. And, of course, since Censorship Central at Twitter suspended her for 12 hours so she couldn't respond herself, which may also shed a bit of light here on the cover-up to boot, Michael Flynn Jr. said she understands the White House press release and agrees with it, noting that she's staying the course to prove the massive, deliberate election fraud that robbed we the people of our votes for President Trump and many other Republican candidates. Eventually, though, via alternative channel, Sidney Powell did manage to issue her statement with more details, saying, I agree with the campaign statement. I'm not part of the campaign's legal team. I never signed a retainer agreement, nor sent the president or the campaign a bill for my expenses or fees. My intent, she said, has always been to expose all the fraud I could find and let the chips fall where they may, whether it be upon Republicans or Democrats. And right there you can see part of the bigger picture. The evidence, she said, that I'm compiling is overwhelming that this software tool was used to shift millions of votes from President Trump and other Republican candidates to Biden and other Democrat candidates. We're proceeding to prepare our lawsuit and plan to file it this week. It will be epic, and we will not allow this great republic, she continued, to be stolen by communists from without and within, or our votes altered or manipulated by foreign actors in Hong Kong, Iran, Venezuela, or Serbia, for example, who have neither regard for human life nor the people who are the engine of this exceptional country. And as we talked about in the first segment, she did make good on that. Vince Lancey via Zero Hedge and the American Thinker and Andrea Woodberg go on to say, you probably already know that Trump's legal team announced that Sidney Powell's not a team member. The brief statement, though, leaves unanswered the most important question of why. Absent solid information, speculation leads us either to this is the beginning of the end or this is all part of the plan. And they say, I'm leaning towards the latter. Events have happened with head-spinning speed. On Thursday, Trump's legal team held a press conference. Rudy Giuliani talked about traditional voter fraud. Voters coming out of the insane asylums, not only by the droves to vote, but also rising from the dead in cemeteries nationwide, faked ballots, etc. Thus, the waste stream chose to focus on his hair. Typical. Sidney Powell talked about corrupt or corruptible election software, a familiar topic to the state of Texas, which rejected Dominion systems for the reasons that are now becoming obvious. By the way, so did the New York Times and some of the top Democrats before it became politically correct to deny such a thing could ever be possible. And Jenna Ellison reminded us that the press conference was not an evidentiary hearing, but was instead an opening argument. For over a week, the piece notes, Powell has been making the media rounds asserting that the system used in a number of states, primarily but not limited to Dominion software running on Smartmatic machines, originated in Venezuela. A couple of engineers that are still associated with the crooked product when Hugo Chavez wanted to buy a system that could clearly swing elections his way. She talked about votes being counted abroad, software changes, and vote manipulation over the Internet. And while her numbers were breathtaking, that Trump had, for example, at least 80 million votes, and in spite of the fact that you'll hear all kinds of baseless claims from the likes of the WAPO, New York Times, and MSDNC that the fraud claims are baseless, Powell has so far cited basically publicly available information. Smartmatic did come out of Venezuela in 2007. They announced that they were selling their Sequoia voting systems to Dominion. The chairman of Smartmatic's board is, in fact, a George Soros crony. The system is, in fact, easily hackable, as has been demonstrated repeatedly, and it's the reason the state of Texas decided against it in so many cases. Georgia's system was clearly vulnerable, and the data coming out of what the author calls the swine states allow anomalies that are clearly statistically impossible, all of which make Powell's contentions at the very minimum sound credible. On Thursday and Friday, there was a public spat between Tucker Carlson and Sidney Powell, where Carlson claimed Powell had no evidence and got nasty when he pushed. Powell asserted she'd offered evidence, but Tucker got nasty because it wasn't what he wanted. And what he evidently wanted was for those that were pushing back on the fraud to tip their hand before they actually get into court, which would obviously be one of the last things a credible attorney trying to prosecute a case like this would want to do. But this is where the plot thickens. Writes Vince Lancey, the Washington Examiner added the claim that, quote, sources close to the president say that Powell lacks evidence, which explains the distancing. Because ask yourself the following. Have there been any of what they call sources close to the president that have ever been correct? They're invariably never Trumpers. And it's possible that this time they might be correct, but that would be statistically unlikely. Still, though, a lot more likely than some of the massive midnight vote spikes that came out of Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Georgia. You know what, folks? I think some of these same sources close to the president were the ones that told him he should give up, after Fox declared Arizona for Biden, too. Powell's response was swift, and of course it's been deleted from Twitter. The chips will fall where they may, she wrote. We will defend the foundations of this great republic. And the hashtag, look for it to be Deep Six too, Kraken on steroids. And in her statements, you might note that Sidney Powell has said she's open for donations, which makes sense, because if Powell represents the president's campaign, the government regulates individual donations. If, on the other hand, she's apart from the campaign, things are much less constrained. And folks, that's particularly important if you're talking about something that would take down a number of very, very high officials in both parties, oh, and also would offend the likes of the CIA and federal bunglers of investigation. You know, it occurs to me that FBI really ought to stand for Friends by Influence. The rest of you can end up like Michael Flynn or Roger Stone or maybe Lavoy Finicum. Oh yeah, and let's not forget a certain church down in Texas, too. So, concludes the authors, there are two ways to view all of this. The it's all over viewpoint suggests Powell overpromised. She's now become a source of danger and mortification who must be jettisoned, but perhaps far more likely, there is a deep game afoot, and there are a lot of moving parts behind that approach. The facts about Dominion Software, Smartmatic, and many others that are yet to be implicated. There is strong statistical indication, I would say overwhelming evidence approaching a statistical proof about voter fraud. There's Powell's statement to Larry O'Connor on Friday that she represents the people and not the president. And finally, there's information that Michael Flynn Jr. and Lynn Wood have provided about the administration separating from Powell for financial reasons and her still being in the fight. And in order to find all the credible evidence you need that there actually is fire here, along with the incredible volume of smoke, just ask yourself whether anybody outside the WAPO New York Times and CNN, that senile, creepy quid pro Joe Biden, who was thrilled with the size of the crowd he'd drawn if he couldn't count it on his fingers, as opposed to Trump drawing well over 50,000, for example, at rallies in Pennsylvania, could have possibly ended up with more votes than the sainted Barack Hussein Obama. And as just about everyone has now realized, proving this epic level of fraud was never going to be easy, and the process is only just beginning. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And yes, folks, the same media that prattled on incessantly for about 4 years about Russia, 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 and foreign interference in U.S. elections now says, oh no, it's not even possible. And although they looked really hard for evidence of election interference before and just couldn't find it, now, they wouldn't recognize it if it was cutting them a check. So as all of that smoke begins to clear, while the waste stream continues to obfuscate, let's take a look back at some other news that should have made things clear before the weekend follies even began. On Thursday night, the should-be infamous criminal conspirators masquerading as a voting machine company, Dominion Voting Systems, abruptly backed out of attending a fact-finding hearing set for Friday morning with the Pennsylvania House State Government Committee, which had been scheduled with the voting machine SICK manufacturer to, quote, help identify and correct any irregularities. Oh, yeah, that's an understatement. In the election process, so they didn't show, prompting State Government Committee Chair Seth Grove to say that the 1.3 million Pennsylvanians that use Dominion's voting SICK machines have been, quote, hung out to dry and slapped in their faces. Let's hear more of his comments from the press conference on Friday morning.
Instead of running towards a light of honesty and integrity, Dominion Voting Systems retreated to the darkness. Why? Why would a vendor of public goods fear discussing their products sold to the public for the public good? If Dominion's products were successful and operated as they were supposed to, why wouldn't Dominion take the opportunity to publicly review its success? How hard is it to say, our ballot machines worked exactly as promised, and they are 100% accurate?
Well, gee, there comes part of the rub. They did work exactly as promised, not to the voters, but to the crooks who purchased them. And to say that they were 100% accurate is probably about as wrong as it gets.
Why, after weeks of accusations, has Dominion Voting Systems not released any analysis of the success of their voting machines to the public in order to stop their accusers in their tracks? They have nothing to hide. Why are they hiding from us? Today, I am saddened to report to the taxpayers of Pennsylvania and the 1.3 million voters who trusted Dominion Voting Systems with their ballots that Dominion Voting Systems has hung you out to dry and slapped you in your faces. Not only are Pennsylvanians more skeptical, but the actions of Dominion Voting Systems last night have led credibility to their accusers' accusations. To date, the Secretary of State has initiated no plan to address any concerns of Pennsylvanians. A concerning number of Pennsylvanians have lost faith in the integrity of our election process. The elections were conducted above board. The Secretary of State and the Department would be falling over themselves to verify the results and put to rest the mistrust of this election.
Whoa, whoa, full stop. And I have to be as kind as I can here to the disgusting slime bags at the New York Times. Where the hell is this story in their op-eds saying, oh, it's the president undermining the faith of Americans in the election process, which is arguably even more crooked than the WAPO New York Times and CCPNN? I can't help but hearken back, folks, to the good old days, because once upon a time, election fraud like this would have been met at the local level with tar and feathers. Instead, as I think is increasingly obvious, their litany of lies is intended to drive us to outright open civil war. John F. Kennedy had it right. Those who would make peaceful revolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable. In this case, of course, it's a counter-revolution against the greatest fraud, and yes, ongoing treason in American history.
Trust must be earned. It's up to Dominion Voting Systems to earn the voters' trust.
That now is simply no longer possible, especially if we still have, as John Adams pointed out, an educated and moral people.
It's up to the Secretary of State to invalidate any rumor or accusation.
And hey, folks, wouldn't it be cool if we still had an honest press that would actually report on it? Why, you might even hear stories like this next one. In this case, I'm looking at a piece from the Hal Turner radio show. While it was apparently single-sourced, it looked more and more credible as the week wore on. Notwithstanding the Associated Press and others that don't seem to like what they're hearing. We'll come back to that. Georgia Republican Governor Brian Kemp and the Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger both allegedly took money from Communist China, says this piece, perhaps to intentionally throw or steal the 3 November election in that state to the creepy senile one. Says Hal Turner, according to very high-level sources from my years working national security intelligence with the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force, the feds have proof of the payments to both Kemp and Raffensperger. Well, wait a minute, Mark. Aren't these unnamed insider sources the kind of thing we don't put much stock in? Well, of course they are, folks. The only time they get reported widely is if they have to do with corruption alleged by so-called insiders against Team Trump. In those cases, the WAPO, New York Times, and usual suspects don't have any trouble reporting on them as if they were gospel at all. We've even seen at least one impeachment of late with far less actual evidence. So, again, I'm not saying this is any less reliable than what the WAPO usually tries to get people to believe. Just making what I hope is an obvious point. The AP spin on this part of the fraud says that Georgia's governor and top election official on Friday certified results, for whatever that's worth, showing Joe Biden is the Fuhrer-elect over President Donald Trump, bringing the state one step closer to wrapping up an election fraught with unfounded accusations of fraud by Trump and his supporters. Blah-de-blah-de-blah. The Republican governor, though, it says, hasn't stepped forward to defend the integrity of this year's elections amid attacks by Trump and other members of his own party who claim, and they say it again, without evidence, good grief, that the presidential vote in Georgia was tainted by fraud. That's a bit like saying a dog hit head-on by a skunk is tainted by a whiff of odor. And about as close as they get to admitting something closer to the truth is this sentence. Kemp said on Friday that he was concerned that the audit, the alleged recount, looked only at ballots, not the signatures on the absentee ballot applications or absentee ballot envelopes. Is that enough to get the so-called Republican governor off the hook? Well, says Hal Turner, the Trump election legal team forced the president to wait before revealing all of this until both Kemp and Raffensperger had certified the election results. Because according to those same sources, once the two partners in crime had certified the results, their crime was complete. Both men certified those results this week. By law, Raffensperger was obliged to certify the election before 5 p.m. on Friday, leaving Kemp until 5 p.m. on Saturday to do the same, and both men did exactly those acts. Writes Hal Turner, the implications of all of this are staggering. First, that a sitting Republican governor would stab his own party's president and our nation in the back on behalf of a foreign government is utterly horrifying. People are already asking, my God, what could they have offered him that he would sell out his own people, his own country? And furthermore, that a foreign nation would dare to pay money to rig or steal a U.S. presidential election is, and you can probably imagine this, a casus belli, or cause for war. And it looks like China does seem to have done exactly that, prompting Turner to suggest that this truly is a justification for war. And he goes on to provide a bit more background information, which is kind of enlightening as well. Georgia Governor Brian P. Kemp ordered state agencies to buy from Chinese Lenovo and interlocking vendors back in March of 2019, undermining U.S. sovereignty, the citizens of Georgia, and the upcoming 2020 election. Those interlocking vendors include members of Obama's Technology Council and members of the IBM Eclipse Foundation, including China's Tsinghua University, that stole the invention of social networking from Columbus, Ohio-based Leader Technologies, including IBM, Dell, EMC, HP, and NetApp, and those systems were among those used in the 2020 election in Georgia. How is it the Secretary of State and election chief didn't know this, since his election machines ran the infrastructure? And that prompts Turner to go into a bit more background on the various money connections, one of whom is a pretty shady character named Lord Mark Malik Brown, who he notes is called the British hand behind at least the European arm of the coup to oust Trump. The tentacles here, through the Clinton Foundation, Soros' Open Society, and related so-called philanthropic, yeah sure, organizations, Nancy Pelosi's chief of staff, and of course the Biden crime family, among many, many others, going all the way up to, most recently, Dominion Voting Systems, Smartmatic, et al., run very, very deep. Back then to Hal Turner and an update from late over the weekend, which says intel sources now also confirm that, quote, other governors, secretaries of state, state election officials, county election officials, and even several big city mayors also allegedly received payments from Communist China, and those payments have been tracked as well. One more then from the good news and bad news category over the weekend, and yeah, this one goes deeper too than it looks, or than the WAPO and New York Times are going to tell you. An Obama judge on Saturday dismissed the Trump campaign's lawsuit in Pennsylvania, seeking to invalidate millions of votes there, rejecting what was called the startling request due to, oh yeah, say it with me, a lack of evidence, especially if na-na-na-na-na, we ain't going to look at it. And they ruled that the state can thus move forward with certifying its election results, whatever that means in the land of the Banana Republic. U.S. Middle District Judge, sick, Matthew Brann, ruled the campaign presented strained legal arguments without merit and speculative accusations that were unsupported by evidence, which, say some, is a major blow to the Trump campaign's efforts to thwart the latest coup attempt. But the good news, says the president and his team, is that one more hurdle is out of the way, setting the stage for the real showdown in the United States Supreme Court. But there's more than that going on here too, folks. On Friday, the U.S. Supreme Court made a reallotment of justices of the court among the various circuits and entered them into the record effective 20 November 2020. Interestingly, just in time for what's coming. And here are the names. See if you see a pattern. For the 8th Circuit, which includes Michigan, Brett M. Kavanaugh. For the 7th Circuit, including Wisconsin, Justice Amy Coney Barrett. For Pennsylvania, in the 5th Circuit, it's Samuel A. Alito. Oh, and interestingly, Justice Alito ordered that ballots received after the state law deadline, which might not be countable, be kept separate from the other ballots on election night. Pennsylvania ignored the judge's order, and some suggest he just might be pissed. Back to the other important part of the list, where in the 11th Circuit, i.e. Georgia, it's Justice Clarence Thomas. So I guess, if nothing else, you could say the plot is thickening. I guess we'll close today with one more bit of censorship over the weekend that really tells us another sign of the times. Remember how Two Facebook tells us it's all about science and facts? Well, at least when it suits their anti-scientific totalitarian agenda. Last week, scientists in Denmark published a revolutionary study demonstrating that mask wearing does very little to mitigate the spread of the booga-booga-booga flu, COVID-19. So guess what happened when the director of the Center for Evidence-Based Medicine at Oxford University, Carl Hannigan, tweeted Friday about an article citing the landmark Danish study that doesn't meet political correctness guidelines. You already know, don't you? The Ministry of Truth at Two Facebook flagged it as false information because of independent fact-checkers who are as ignorant of real science as the New York Times is evidence. Be skeptical. Be very skeptical.